This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow, read by Scott Brick. Observations by Alexander Hamilton. I have thought it my duty to exhibit things as they are, not as they ought to be. Letter of August 13th, 1782. The passions of a revolution are apt to hurry even good men into excesses. Essay of August 12th, 1795. Men are rather reasoning than reasonable animals, for the most part governed by the impulse of passion. Letter of April 16th, 1802. Opinion, whether well or ill-founded, is the governing principle of human affairs. Letter of June 18th, 1778. Prologue. The Oldest Revolutionary War Widow. In the early 1850s, few pedestrians strolling past the house on H Street in Washington, near the White House, realized that the ancient widow seated by the window, knitting and arranging flowers, was the last surviving link to the glory days of the early Republic. 50 years earlier, on a rocky, secluded ledge overlooking the Hudson River in Weehawken, New Jersey, Aaron Burr, the Vice President of the United States, had fired a mortal shot at her husband, Alexander Hamilton, in a misbegotten effort to remove the man Burr regarded as the main impediment to the advancement of his career. Hamilton was then 49 years old. Was it a benign or a cruel destiny that had compelled the widow to outlive her husband by half a century, struggling to raise 7 children and surviving almost until the eve of the Civil War? Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton, purblind and deaf but gallant to the end, was a stoic woman who never yielded to self-pity. With her gentle manner, Dutch tenacity, and quiet humor, she clung to the deeply rooted religious beliefs that had abetted her reconciliation to the extraordinary misfortunes she had endured. Even in her early 90s, she still dropped to her knees for family prayers. Wrapped in shawls and garbed in the black bombazine dresses that were de rigueur for widows, she wore a starched white ruff and frilly white cap that bespoke a simpler era in American life. The dark eyes that gleamed behind large metal-rimmed glasses, those same dark eyes that had once enchanted a young officer on General George Washington's staff, betokened a sharp intelligence, a fiercely indomitable spirit, and a memory that refused to surrender the past. In the front parlor of the house she now shared with her daughter, Eliza Hamilton had crammed the faded memorabilia of her now distant marriage. When visitors called, the tiny, erect, white-haired lady would grab her cane, rise gamely from a black sofa embroidered with a floral pattern of her own design, and escort them to a Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington. She motioned with pride to a silver wine cooler tucked discreetly beneath the center table that had been given to the Hamiltons by Washington himself. This treasured gift retained a secret meaning for Eliza, for it had been a tacit gesture of solidarity from Washington when her husband was ensnared in the first major sex scandal in American history. The tour's highlight stood enshrined in the corner, a marble bust of her dead hero, carved by an Italian sculptor, Giuseppe Ciaracchi, during Hamilton's heyday as the first Treasury Secretary. Portrayed in the classical style of a noble Roman senator, a toga draped across one shoulder, Hamilton exuded a brisk energy and a massive intelligence in his wide brow, his face illumined by the half-smile that often played about his features. This was how Eliza wished to recall him, ardent, hopeful, and eternally young. "That bust I can never forget," one young visitor remembered, "for the old lady always paused before it in her tour of the rooms and, leaning on her cane, gazed and gazed as if she could never be satisfied." For the select few, Eliza unearthed documents written by Hamilton that qualified as her sacred scripture. An early hymn he had composed or a letter he had drafted during his impoverished boyhood on St. Croix. She frequently grew melancholy and longed for a reunion with her Hamilton, as she invariably referred to him. "One night, I remember, she seemed sad and absent-minded and could not go to the parlor where there were visitors, but sat near the fire and played backgammon for a while," said one caller. "When the game was done, she leaned back in her chair a long time with closed eyes, as if lost to all around her." There was a long silence, broken by the murmured words, "I am so tired. It is so long. I want to see Hamilton. Eliza Hamilton was committed to one holy quest above all others, to rescue her husband's historical reputation from the gross slanders that had tarnished it. For many years after the duel, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and other political enemies had taken full advantage of their eloquence and longevity to spread defamatory anecdotes about Hamilton, who had been condemned to everlasting silence. Determined to preserve her husband's legacy, Eliza enlisted as many as 30 assistants to sift through his tall stacks of papers. Unfortunately, she was so self-effacing and so reverential toward her husband that though she salvaged every scrap of his writing, she apparently destroyed her own letters. The capstone of her monumental labor, her life's dearest object, was the publication of a mammoth authorized biography that would secure Hamilton's niche in the pantheon of the early republic. It was a long, exasperating wait as one biographer after another discarded the project or expired before its completion. Almost by default, the giant enterprise fell to her fourth son, John Church Hamilton, who belatedly disgorged a 7-volume history of his father's exploits. Before this hagiographic tribute was completed, however, Eliza Hamilton died at 97 on November 9th, 1854. Distraught that their mother had waited vainly for decades to see her husband's life immortalized, Eliza Hamilton Holly scolded her brother for his overdue biography. Lately in my hours of sadness, recurring to such interests as most deeply affected our blessed mother, I could recall none more frequent or more absorbent than her devotion to our father. When blessed memory shows her gentle countenance and her untiring spirit before me, in this one great and beautiful aspiration after duty, I feel the same spark ignite and bid me to seek the fulfillment of her words, "Justice shall be done to the memory of my Hamilton." It was, Eliza Hamilton Holly noted pointedly, the imperative duty that Eliza had bequeathed to all her children. "Justice shall be done to the memory of my Hamilton." Well, has justice been done? Few figures in American history have aroused such visceral love or loathing as Alexander Hamilton. To this day, he seems trapped in a crude historical cartoon that pits Jeffersonian democracy against Hamiltonian aristocracy. For Jefferson and his followers, wedded to their vision of an agrarian Eden, Hamilton was the American Mephistopheles, the proponent of such devilish contrivances as banks, factories, and stock exchanges. They demonized him as a slavish pawn of the British crown, a closet monarchist, a Machiavellian intriguer, a would-be Caesar. Noah Webster contended that Hamilton's ambition, pride, and overbearing temper had destined him to be the evil genius of this country. Hamilton's powerful vision of American nationalism, with states subordinate to a strong central government and led by a vigorous executive branch, aroused fears of a reversion to royal British ways. His seeming solicitude for the rich caused critics to portray him as a snobbish tool of plutocrats who was contemptuous of the masses. For another group of naysayers, Hamilton's unswerving faith in a professional military converted him into a potential despot. "From the first to the last words he wrote," concluded historian Henry Adams, "I read always the same Napoleonic kind of adventuredom." Even some Hamilton admirers have been unsettled by a faint tincture of something foreign in this West Indian transplant. Woodrow Wilson grudgingly praised Hamilton as a very great man, but not a great American. Yet many distinguished commentators have echoed Eliza Hamilton's lament that justice has not been done to her Hamilton. He has tended to lack the glittering multi-volume biographies that have burnished the fame of other founders. The British statesman Lord Bryce singled out Hamilton as the one founding father who had not received his due from posterity. In the American Commonwealth, he observed, "One cannot note the disappearance of this brilliant figure, to Europeans the most interesting in the early history of the Republic, without the remark that his countrymen seem to have never, either in his lifetime or afterwards, duly recognized his splendid gifts." During the robust era of progressive republicanism, marked by brawny nationalism and energetic government, Theodore Roosevelt took up the cudgels and declared Hamilton the most brilliant American statesman who ever lived, possessing the loftiest and keenest intellect of his time. His White House successor, William Howard Taft, likewise embraced Hamilton as our greatest constructive statesman. In all probability, Alexander Hamilton is the foremost political figure in American history who never attained the presidency, yet he probably had a much deeper and more lasting impact than many who did. Hamilton was the supreme double threat among the founding fathers, at once thinker and doer, sparkling theoretician and masterful executive. He and James Madison were the prime movers behind the summoning of the Constitutional Convention and the chief authors of that classic gloss on the National Charter, the Federalist, which Hamilton supervised. As the first Treasury Secretary and principal architect of the new government, Hamilton took constitutional principles and infused them with expansive life, turning abstractions into institutional realities. He had a pragmatic mind that minted comprehensive programs. In contriving the smoothly running machinery of a modern nation-state, including a budget system, a funded debt, a tax system, a central bank, a customs service, and a coast guard, and justifying them in some of America's most influential state papers, he set a high-water mark for administrative competence that has never been equaled. If Jefferson provided the essential poetry of American political discourse, Hamilton established the prose of American statecraft. No other founder articulated such a clear and prescient vision of America's future political, military, and economic strength, or crafted such ingenious mechanisms to bind the nation together. Hamilton's crowded years as Treasury Secretary scarcely exhaust the epic story of his short life, which was stuffed with high drama. From his illegitimate birth on Nevis to his bloody downfall in Weehawken, Hamilton's life was so tumultuous that only an audacious novelist could have dreamed it up. He embodied an enduring archetype, the obscure immigrant who comes to America, recreates himself, and succeeds despite a lack of proper birth and breeding. The saga of his metamorphosis from an anguished clerk on St. Croix to the reigning presence in George Washington's cabinet offers both a gripping personal story and a panoramic view of the formative years of the Republic. Except for Washington, nobody stood closer to the center of American politics from 1776 to 1800, or cropped up at more turning points. More than anyone else, the omnipresent Hamilton galvanized, inspired, and scandalized the newborn nation, serving as the flashpoint for pent-up conflicts of class, geography, race, religion, and ideology. His contemporaries often seemed defined by how they reacted to the political gauntlets that he threw down repeatedly with such defiant panache. Hamilton was an exuberant genius who performed at a fiendish pace and must have produced the maximum number of words that a human being can scratch out in 49 years. If promiscuous with his political opinions, however, he was famously reticent about his private life, especially his squalid Caribbean boyhood. No other founder had to grapple with such shame and misery, and his early years have remained wrapped in more mystery than those of any other major American statesman. While not scanting his vibrant intellectual life, I have tried to gather anecdotal material that will bring this cerebral man to life as both a public and private figure. Charming and impetuous, romantic and witty, dashing and headstrong, Hamilton offers the biographer an irresistible psychological study. For all his superlative mental gifts, he was afflicted with a touchy ego that made him querulous and fatally combative. He never outgrew the stigma of his illegitimacy, and his exquisite tact often gave way to egregious failures of judgment that left even his keenest admirers aghast. If capable of numerous close friendships, he also entered into titanic feuds with Jefferson, Madison, Adams, Monroe, and Burr. The magnitude of Hamilton's feats as Treasury Secretary has overshadowed many other facets of his life. Clerk, college student, youthful poet, essayist, artillery captain, wartime adjutant to Washington, battlefield hero, congressman, abolitionist, Bank of New York founder, state assemblyman, member of the Constitutional Convention and New York Ratifying Convention, orator, lawyer, polemicist, educator, patron saint of the New York Evening Post, foreign policy theorist, and major general in the Army. Boldly uncompromising, he served as catalyst for the emergence of the first political parties and as the intellectual fountainhead for one of them, the Federalists. He was a pivotal force in four consecutive presidential elections, and he defined much of America's political agenda during the Washington and Adams administrations, leaving copious commentary on virtually every salient issue of the day. Earlier generations of biographers had to rely on only a meager portion of his voluminous output. Between 1961 and 1987, Harold C. Sirrett and his doughty editorial team at Columbia University Press published 27 thick volumes of Hamilton's personal and political papers. Julius Goebel Jr. and his staff added 5 volumes of legal and business papers to the groaning shelf, bringing the total haul to 22,000 pages. These meticulous additions are much more than exhaustive compilations of Hamilton's writings. They are a scholar's feast, enriched with expert commentary as well as contemporary newspaper extracts, letters, and diary entries. No biographer has fully harvested these riches. I have supplemented this research with extensive archival work that has uncovered, among other things, dozens of revealing new articles written by Hamilton himself. To retrieve his early life from often impenetrable obscurity, I have also scoured records in Scotland, England, Denmark, and 8 Caribbean islands, not to mention many domestic archives. The resulting portrait, I hope, will seem fresh and surprising even to those best versed in the literature of the period. It is an auspicious time to re-examine the life of Hamilton, who was the prophet of the capitalist revolution in America. If Jefferson enunciated the more ample view of political democracy, Hamilton possessed the finer sense of economic opportunity. He was the messenger from a future that we now inhabit. We have left behind the rosy agrarian rhetoric and slaveholding reality of Jeffersonian democracy and reside in the bustling world of trade, industry, stock markets, and banks that Hamilton envisioned. Hamilton's staunch abolitionism formed an integral feature of this economic vision. He has also emerged as the uncontested visionary in anticipating the shape and powers of the federal government. At a time when Jefferson and Madison celebrated legislative power as the purest expression of the popular will, Hamilton argued for a dynamic executive branch and an independent judiciary, along with a professional military, a central bank, and an advanced financial system. Today we are indisputably the heirs to Hamilton's America. And to repudiate his legacy is, in many ways, to repudiate the modern world. Chapter 1. The Castaways. Alexander Hamilton claimed Nevis in the British West Indies as his birthplace, although no surviving records substantiate this. Today, the tiny island seems little more than a colorful speck in the Caribbean, an exotic tourist hideaway. 1 million years ago, the land that is now Nevis Peak thrust up from the seafloor to form the island, and the extinct volcanic cone still intercepts the trade winds at an altitude of 3,200 feet, its jagged peak often obscured behind a thick swirl of clouds. This omnipresent mountain, looming over jungles, plunging gorges, and verdant foothills that sweep down to sandy beaches, made the island a natural fortress for the British. It abounded in both natural wonders and horrors. In 1690, the first capital, Jamestown, was swallowed whole by the sea during an earthquake and tidal wave. To modern eyes, Nevis may seem like a sleepy backwater to which Hamilton was confined before his momentous escape to St. Croix and North America. But if we adjust our vision to 18th-century realities, we see that this West Indian setting was far from marginal. The crossroads of a bitter maritime rivalry among European powers, vying for mastery of the lucrative sugar trade. A small revolution in consumer tastes had turned the Caribbean into prized acreage for growing sugarcane to sweeten the coffee, tea, and cocoa imbibed in fashionable European capitals. As a result, the small scattered islands generated more wealth for Britain than all of her North American colonies combined. The West Indians vastly outweigh us of the northern colonies, Benjamin Franklin grumbled in the 1760s. After the French and Indian War, the British vacillated about whether to swap all of Canada for the island of Guadeloupe. In the event, the French toasted their own diplomatic cunning in retaining the Sugar Island. The sudden popularity of sugar, dubbed white gold, engendered a brutal world of overnight fortunes in which slavery proved indispensable. Since indigenous Caribbeans and Europeans balked at toiling in the sweltering canebrakes, thousands of blacks were shipped from slave trading forts in West Africa to cultivate Nevis and the neighboring islands. British authorities colonized Nevis with vagabonds, criminals, and other riffraff swept from the London streets to work as indentured servants or overseers. In 1727, the minister of a local Anglican church, aching for some glimmer of spirituality, regretted that the slaves were inclined to laziness, stealing, stubbornness, murmuring, treachery, lying, drunkenness, and the like. But he reserved his most scathing strictures for a rowdy white populace composed of whole shiploads of pickpockets, whores, rogues, vagrants, thieves, sodomites, and other filth and cutthroats of society. Trapped in this beautiful but godless spot, the minister bemoaned that the British imports were not bad enough for the gallows and yet too bad to live among their virtuous countrymen at home. While other founding fathers were reared in tidy New England villages or cosseted on baronial Virginia estates, Hamilton grew up in a tropical hellhole of dissipated whites and fractious slaves, all framed by a backdrop of luxuriant natural beauty. On both his maternal and paternal sides, Hamilton's family clung to the insecure middle rung of West Indian life, squeezed between plantation aristocrats above and street rabble and unruly slaves below. Taunted as a bastard throughout his life, Hamilton was understandably reluctant to chat about his childhood. "My birth is the subject of the most humiliating criticism," he wrote in one pained confession, and he turned his early family history into a taboo topic, alluded to in only a couple of cryptic letters. He described his maternal grandfather, the physician John Fawcett, as a French Huguenot who emigrated to the West Indies in consequence of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes and settled in the island of Nevis and there acquired a pretty fortune. Revoked in 1685 by Louis XIV, the Edict of Nantes had guaranteed religious toleration for French Protestants. "I have been assured by persons who knew him that he was a man of letters and much of a gentleman." Born 10 years after his grandfather's death, Hamilton may have embellished the sketch with a touch of gentility. In the slave-based economy, physicians often attended the auctions, checking the teeth of the human chattel and making them run, leap, and jump, to test whatever strength remained after the grueling middle passage. No white in the Sugar Islands was entirely exempt from the pervasive taint of slavery. The archives of St. George's Parish in the fertile, mountainous Gingerland section of Nevis record the marriage of John Fawcett to a British woman, Mary Uppington, on August 21, 1718. By that point, they already had 2 children, a daughter Anne and a son John, the latter arriving 2 months before the wedding. In all likelihood, lulled by the casual mores of the tropics, the Fawcetts decided to formalize their link after the birth of their 2nd child, having lived until then as a common-law couple, an expedient adopted by Hamilton's own parents. In all, the Fawcetts produced 7 children, Hamilton's mother Rachel being the 2nd youngest, born circa 1729. A persistent mythology in the Caribbean asserts that Rachel was partly black, making Alexander Hamilton a quadroon or octoroon. In this obsessively race-conscious society, however, Rachel was invariably listed among the whites on local tax rolls. Her identification as someone of mixed race has no basis in verifiable fact. The folklore that Hamilton was mulatto probably arose from the incontestable truth that many, if not most, illegitimate children in the West Indies bore mixed blood. At the time of Rachel's birth, the 4,000 slaves on Nevis outnumbered whites by a ratio of 4 to 1, making inequitable carnal relations between black slaves and white masters a dreadful commonplace. Occupying a house in the southern Nevis foothills, the Fawcetts owned a small sugar plantation and had at least 7 slaves, pretty typical for the petite bourgeoisie. That Nevis later had a small black village named Fawcett, an anglicized version of the family name, confirms their ownership of slaves who later assumed their surname. The Sugar Islands were visited so regularly by epidemics of almost biblical proportions, malaria, dysentery, and yellow fever being the worst offenders, that 5 Fawcett children perished in infancy or childhood, leaving only Rachel and her much older sister Anne as survivors. Even aided by slaves, small planters found it a tough existence. Skirting the volcanic cone, the Nevis Hills were so steep and rocky that even when terraced, they proved troublesome for sugar cultivation. The island steadily lost its economic eminence, especially after a mysterious plant disease, aggravated by drought, slowly crept across Nevis in 1737 and denuded it of much of its lush vegetation. This prompted a mass exodus of refugees, including Anne Fawcett, who had married a well-to-do planter named James Lytton. They decamped to the Danish island of St. Croix, charting an escape route that Hamilton's parents were to follow. Evidence indicates that the Fawcett marriage was marred by perpetual squabbling, perhaps compounded by the back-to-back deaths of two of their children in 1736 and the blight that parched the island the next year. Mary Fawcett was a pretty, socially ambitious woman and probably not content to dawdle on a stagnant island. Determined and resourceful, with a clear knack for cultivating powerful men, she appealed to the Chancellor of the Leeward Islands for a legal separation from her husband. In the 1740 settlement, the Fawcetts agreed to live separately and apart for the rest of their lives, and Mary renounced all rights to her husband's property in exchange for an inadequate annuity of £53. It is possible that she and Rachel traversed the narrow 2-mile strait to St. Kitts, where they may even have first encountered a young Scottish nobleman named James Hamilton. Because her mother had surrendered all claims to John Fawcett's money, 16-year-old Rachel Fawcett achieved the sudden glow of a minor heiress in 1745 when her father died and left her all his property. Since Rachel was bright, beautiful, and strong-willed, traits we can deduce from subsequent events, she must have been hotly pursued in a world chronically deficient in well-heeled, educated European women. Rachel and her mother decided to start anew on St. Croix, where James and Anne Lytton had prospered, building a substantial estate outside the capital, Christiansted, called The Grange. The Lyttons likely introduced them to another newcomer from Nevis, a Dane named Johann Michael Levien, who had peddled household goods and now aspired to planter status. The name Levien can be a Sephardic variant of Levine, but if he was Jewish, he managed to conceal his origins. Had he presented himself as a Jew, the snobbish Mary Fawcett would certainly have squelched the match in a world that frowned on religious no less than interracial intermarriage. From fragmentary evidence, Levien emerges as a man who dreamed of plucking sudden riches from the New World, but stumbled, like others, into multiple disappointments. The year before he met Rachel, he squandered much of his paltry capital on a minor St. Croix sugar plantation. On this island of grand estates, a profitable operation required 50 or 100 slaves, something beyond the reveries of the thinly capitalized Levien. He then lowered his sights appreciably and, trying to become a planter on the cheap, acquired a 50% stake in a small cotton plantation. He ended up deeply in hock to the Danish West India and Guinea Company. Beyond her apparent physical allure, Rachel Fawcett must have represented a fresh source of ready cash for Levien. For Alexander Hamilton, Johann Michael Levien was the certified ogre of his family saga. He wrote, "A Dane, a fortune hunter of the name of Levine, Hamilton spelling, came to Nevis bedizened with gold and paid his addresses to my mother, then a handsome young woman having a snug fortune." In the 18th century, a snug fortune signified one sufficient for a comparatively easy life. Partial to black silk gowns and blue vests with bright gold buttons, Levien was a flashy dresser and must have splurged on such finery to hide his threadbare budget and palm himself off on Mary Fawcett as an affluent suitor. Hamilton rued the day that his grandmother was captivated by the glitter of Levien's appearance and auctioned her daughter off, as it were, to the highest bidder. In compliance with the wishes of her mother, but against her own inclination, Hamilton stated, the 16-year-old Rachel agreed to marry the older Levien, her senior by at least a dozen years. In Hamilton's blunt estimation, it was a hated marriage, as the daughter of one unhappy union was rushed straight into another. In 1745, the ill-fated wedding took place at The Grange. The newlyweds set up house on their own modest plantation, which was named, with macabre irony, Contentment. The following year, the teenage bride gave birth to a son, Peter, destined to be her one legitimate child. One wonders if Rachel ever submitted to further conjugal relations with Levian. Even if Levian was not the coarse man of repulsive personality evoked by Hamilton's grandson, it seems clear that Rachel felt stifled by her older husband, finding him crude and insufferable. In 1748, Levian bought a half share in another small sugar plantation, enlarging his debt and frittering away Rachel's fast dwindling inheritance. The marriage deteriorated to the point where the headstrong wife simply abandoned the house around 1750. A vindictive Levian ranted in a subsequent divorce decree that while Rachel had lived with him, she had committed such errors which, as between husband and wife, were indecent and very suspicious. In his severe judgment, she was shameless, coarse, and ungodly. Enraged, his pride bruised, Levian was determined to humiliate his unruly bride. Seizing on a Danish law that allowed a husband to jail his wife if she was twice found guilty of adultery and no longer resided with him, he had Rachel clapped into the dreaded Christiansværn, the Christiansted fort, which did double duty as the town jail. Rachel has sometimes been portrayed as a prostitute. One of Hamilton's journalistic nemeses branded him the son of a camp girl, but such insinuations are absurd. On the other hand, that Levian broadcast his accusations against her and met no outright refutation suggests that Rachel had indeed flouted social convention and found solace in the arms of other men. Perched on the edge of Gallows Bay, Fort Christiansværn had cannon that could be trained on pirates or enemy ships crossing the coral reef, as well as smaller artillery that could be swiveled landward and used to suppress slave insurrections. In this ghastly place, unspeakable punishments were meted out to rebellious blacks who had committed heinous crimes, striking whites, torching cane fields, or dashing off to freedom. They could be whipped, branded, and castrated, shackled with heavy leg irons, and entombed in filthy dungeons. The remaining cells tended to be populated by town drunks, petty thieves, and the other dregs of white society. It seems that no woman other than Rachel Levian was ever imprisoned there for adultery. Rachel spent several months in a dank, cramped cell that measured 10 by 13 feet, and she must have gone through infernal torments of fear and loneliness. Through a small, deeply inset window, she could stare across sharpened spikes that encircled the outer wall and gaze at blue-green water that sparkled in fierce tropical sunlight. She could also eavesdrop on the busy wharf, stacked with hogsheads of sugar, which her son Alexander would someday frequent as a young clerk in a trading firm. All the while, she had to choke down a nauseating diet of salted herring, codfish, and boiled yellow cornmeal mush. As an amateur psychologist, Levian left something to be desired, for he imagined that when Rachel was released after 3 to 5 months, this broken woman would now tamely submit to his autocratic rule, that everything would be better and that she, like a true wife, would have changed her ungodly mode of life and would live with him as was meet and fitting, as the divorce decree later proclaimed. He had not reckoned on her invincible spirit. Solitude had only stiffened her resolve to expel Levian from her life. As Hamilton later philosophized in another context, 'tis only to consult our own hearts to be convinced that nations like individuals revolt at the idea of being guided by external compulsion. After Rachel left the fort, she spent a week with her mother, who was living with one of St. Croix's overlords, town captain Bertram Peter de Nully, and supporting herself by sewing and renting out her 3 slaves. Then Rachel did something brave but reckless that sealed her future status as a pariah. She fled the island, abandoning both Levian and her sole son, Peter. In doing so, she relinquished the future benefits of a legal separation and inadvertently doomed the unborn Alexander to illegitimacy. In her proud defiance of persecution, her mental toughness, and her willingness to court controversy, it is hard not to see a startling preview of her son's passionately willful behavior. When she left for St. Kitts in 1750, Rachel seems to have been accompanied by her mother, who announced her departure to creditors in a newspaper notice and settled her debts. Rachel must have imagined that she would never again set eyes on St. Croix, and that the vengeful Levian had inflicted his final lash. Alexander Hamilton may have been musing upon his mother's marriage to Livian when he later observed, "'Tis a very good thing when their stars unite two people who are fit for each other, who have souls capable of relishing the sweets of friendship and sensibilities. But it's a dog of a life when two dissonant tempers meet. When the time came for choosing his own wife, he would proceed with special care." Hamilton's other star-crossed parent, James Hamilton, had also been bedeviled by misfortune in the islands. Born around 1718, he was the fourth of 11 children, 9 sons, 2 daughters, of Alexander Hamilton, the Laird of Grange in Stevenston Parish in Ayrshire, Scotland, southwest of Glasgow. In 1711, that Alexander Hamilton, the 14th Laird in the so-called Cambuskeath line of Hamiltons, married Elizabeth Pollock, the daughter of a baronet. As Alexander must have heard ad nauseam in his boyhood, the Cambuskeath Hamiltons possessed a coat of arms, and for centuries had owned a castle near Kilmarnock called the Grange. Indeed, that lineage can be traced back to the 14th century in impeccable genealogical tables, and he boasted in later years that he was the scion of a blue-ribbon Scottish family. The truth is that on the question who my parents were, I have better pretensions than most of those who in this country plume themselves on ancestry. In 1685, the family took possession of ivy-covered Kirrilaw Castle, set prominently on windswept hills above the little seaside town of Stevenston. Today, just a mound of picturesque ruins, the stately pile then featured a great hall with graceful Gothic windows and came complete with its own barony. The castle stands on the rather steep, wooded bank of a small stream and overlooks a beautiful glen, wrote one newspaper, while the structure stood intact. The castle's occupants enjoyed a fine, if often fog-bound, view of the island of Arran across the Firth of Clyde. Then, as now, the North Ayrshire countryside consisted of gently rolling meadows that were well watered by streams and ponds. Cows and horses browsed on largely treeless hillsides. At the time James Hamilton grew up in Kirrilaw Castle, the family estate was so huge that it encompassed not just Stevenston, but half the arable land in the parish. Aside from a cottage industry of weavers and a small band of artisans who made jews' harps, most local residents huddled in cold hovels, subsisted on a gruesome oatmeal diet, and eked out hard-scrabble lives as tenant farmers for the Hamiltons. For all his storybook upbringing in the castle and high-born pedigree, James Hamilton faced uncertain prospects. As the fourth son, he had little chance of ever inheriting the storied title of Laird of Grange, and like all younger brothers in this precarious spot, he was expected to go off and fend for himself. As his son Alexander noted, his father, as a younger son of a numerous family, was bred to trade. From the sketchy information that can be gleaned about James's siblings, it seems that he was the black sheep of the family, marked for mediocrity. While James had no formal education to speak of, 2 older and 2 younger brothers attended the University of Glasgow, and most of his siblings found comfortable niches in the world. Brother John financed manufacturing and insurance ventures. Brother Alexander became a surgeon, Brother Walter a doctor and apothecary, and Brother William a prosperous tobacco merchant, while Sister Elizabeth married the surveyor of customs for Port Glasgow. Easygoing and lackadaisical, devoid of the ambition that would propel his spirited son, James Hamilton did not seem to internalize the Glaswegian ethos of hard work and strict discipline. One has the impression that his eldest brother John, now Laird of Grange, was no country squire riding to hounds, but an active, enterprising man who was intensely involved in the banking, shipping, and textile business revolutionizing Glasgow. This cathedral and university town, rhapsodized by Daniel Defoe in the 1720s as the most beautiful little town in Britain, already breathed a lively commercial spirit of the sort that later appealed to Alexander Hamilton. After the 1707 union with England as Scottish trade with the North American and West Indian colonies boomed, merchant princes grew rich trafficking in sugar, tobacco, and cotton. In November 1737, John Hamilton took the affable but feckless James, then 19, and steered him into a 4-year apprenticeship with an innovative Glasgow businessman named Richard Allen. Allen had executed a daring raid on Dutch industrial secrets. one that strikingly anticipates what Alexander Hamilton later attempted in bringing manufacturing to Paterson, New Jersey, and helped to pioneer the linen industry in Scotland with his Harlem linen and dye manufactory. In 1741, John Hamilton teamed up with Allen and three Glasgow grandees, Archibald Ingram, John Glassford, and James Deckman, to form the Glasgow Inkle Factory, which produced linen tapes, inkles, that were used in making lace. Hamilton's partners were the commercial royalty of Glasgow, who drove about in fancy coaches, presided over landed estates, and dominated the River Clyde with their ocean-going vessels. For many years, these men would tirelessly bail out the hapless James Hamilton from recurrent financial scrapes. The onerous 4-year contract that James Hamilton signed with Richard Allen in 1737 was a form of legal bondage that obligated him to work as both an apprentice and servant. John Hamilton paid Allen £45 sterling to groom his younger brother in the textile trade. In exchange, James would receive room, board, and fresh linen in the Allen household, but no guaranteed holidays or free weekend time. John Hamilton must have thought that he was shepherding the wayward James into a promising new industry. In time, the linen industry indeed proved profitable, but during this startup phase, it was a dispiriting, money-draining proposition. So when the apprenticeship agreement expired in 1741, James Hamilton decided to test his luck in the West Indies. Many young aristocrats flocked to the West Indian sugar islands, seduced by a common fantasy. They would amass a quick fortune as planters or merchants, then return to Europe, flush with cash, and snap up magnificent estates. The Glasgow countryside was studded with the country houses of winners in this sweepstakes. Great shiploads of sugar traveled from the West Indian islands to Glasgow's boiling houses or refineries, and its distilleries produced brandy from that sugar. Beyond the sugar trade, industrious Scots also operated stores that sold provisions to plantations and marketed their produce. One historian has noted, their emporiums were crammed with full lines of European and North American goods, hardware, draperies, clothing, shoes, and whatnot, and much resembled warehouses. Of all the Caribbean islands, few enjoyed more intimate connections with Glasgow than St. Christopher and the Leeward Islands, commonly known as St. Kitts. More than half of the island's original land grants were awarded to Scots. As the son of a Scottish laird, James Hamilton must have started out with a modicum of social cachet in St. Kitts, but it was never enhanced by money or business success. Trading sugar or plantation supplies in the West Indies was hazardous to those with skimpy capital. Clients demanded credit from these middlemen, who had to carry the risk for merchandise until it was resold in Europe. Meanwhile, they had to pay the sugar duties. The slightest error in calculation or payment delay could swamp a trader in catastrophic losses. Some such fate probably overtook James Hamilton, who faltered quickly and had to be rescued repeatedly by his brother John and his Glasgow friends. In capacity of a merchant, he went to St. Kitts, where from too generous and too easy a temper he failed in business and at length fell into indigent circumstances, his son Alexander wrote in tactful tones. He spoke of his father in a forgiving tone, tinged with pity rather than scorn. It was his fault to have had too much pride and too large a portion of indolence, but his character was otherwise without reproach, and his manners those of a gentleman. In short, Hamilton saw his father as amiable but lazily inept. He inherited his father's pride, though not his indolence, and his exceptional capacity for work was its own unspoken commentary about his father's. James Hamilton had little notion that his protective older brother was acting as his lender of last resort, for John exhorted his brother's creditors to mask his role, cautioning one creditor in 1749, "My brother does not know I am engaged for him." From John Hamilton's letters, one senses that James was distant, even estranged from his family. The last letter his mother had from him was some time ago, where he writes he had bills, but at that time they were not due, John disclosed in one letter to a business associate. Perhaps embarrassed by his perennial bungling, James seems to have concealed the scope of his financial troubles. That James Hamilton's career likely lay in ruins before Rachel Fawcett Levien materialized is suggested by the minutes of the St. Kitts Council meeting of July 15, 1748, which reported that he had taken the oath either of a watchman or a wayman. Insects have unfortunately eaten the middle letters for the port of Basseterre, the island's capital. So if his stint in the tropics was meant to be a fleeting, money-making interlude, it had begun to turn into a permanent trap instead. Many young European fortune-seekers, expecting to return home, would take a temporary black or mulatto mistress and defer marriage until safely back on native soil. That his plans had drastically miscarried would have made James Hamilton more receptive to a romantic liaison with a separated European woman, now that he knew he was not going to see Scotland again anytime soon. By the time Rachel met James Hamilton for certain in St. Kitts in the early 1750s, a certain symmetry had shaped their lives. They were both scarred by early setbacks, had suffered a vertiginous descent in social standing, and had grappled with the terrors of downward economic mobility. Each would have been excluded from the more rarefied society of the British West Indies and tempted to choose a mate from the limited population of working whites. Their liaison was the sort of match that could easily produce a son hypersensitive about class and status, and painfully conscious that social hierarchies ruled the world. Divorce was a novelty in the 18th century. To obtain one in the Crown colonies was an expensive, tortuous affair, and this deprived James and Rachel of any chance to legitimize their match. Putting the best face on the embarrassing situation, Alexander sometimes pretended that his parents had married. Of Rachel's flight from St. Croix, he declared, "My mother afterwards went to St. Kitts, became acquainted with my father, and a marriage between them ensued, followed by many years' cohabitation and several children." Since the relationship may have lasted 15 years, it presumably took on the trappings of a marriage, enabling Alexander to maintain that his illegitimacy was a mere legal technicality and had nothing to do with negligent or profligate parents. Indeed, Hamilton's parents, though a common-law couple, presented themselves as James and Rachel Hamilton. They had two sons, James Jr. and, 2 years later, Alexander. Since Hamilton spoke of his mother's bearing several children, other siblings may have died in childhood. The personalities of James and Rachel Hamilton evoked by Alexander's descendants have a slightly unreal, even sanitized quality. Hamilton's own son John conjured up Rachel as a woman of superior intellect, elevated sentiment, and unusual grace of person and manner. To her he was indebted for his genius. Perhaps no less fanciful was the paternal portrait daubed by Hamilton's grandson, Alan McLean Hamilton. Hamilton's father does not appear to have been successful in any pursuit, but in many ways was a great deal of a dreamer and something of a student, whose chief happiness seemed to be in the society of his beautiful and talented wife, who was in every way intellectually his superior. Is this cozy domestic scene based on credible oral history or family public relations? The documentary record is, alas, mute. The one inescapable impression we have is that Hamilton received his brains and implacable willpower from his mother, not from his errant, indolent father. On the other hand, his father's Scottish ancestry enabled Alexander to daydream that he was not merely a West Indian outcast, consigned forever to a lowly status, but an aristocrat in disguise, waiting to declare his true identity and act his part on a grander stage. Few questions bedevil Hamilton biographers more than the baffling matter of his year of birth. For a long time, historians accepted 1757, the year used by Hamilton himself and his family. Yet several cogent pieces of evidence from his Caribbean period have caused many recent historians to opt for 1755. In 1766, Hamilton affixed his signature as the witness to a legal document, a dubious honor if he was only 9. In 1768, a probate court in St. Croix reported his age as 13, highly compelling evidence since it did not rely on his testimony but came from his uncle. When Alexander published a poem in a St. Croix newspaper in 1771, the aspiring bard informed the editor, "Sir, I am a youth about 17, an adolescent's way of stating that he was 16, which would also tally with the 1755 date. The mass of evidence from the period after Hamilton's arrival in North America does suggest 1757 as his birth year, but preferring the integrity of contemporary over retrospective evidence, we will opt here for a birthday of January 11, 1755. From her father, Rachel had inherited a waterfront property on the main street in Charlestown, the Nevis capital, where legend proclaims that Alexander was born and lived as a boy. If so, he would have seen off to the left the town anchorage and a bright expanse of water, crowded with slave and cargo ships. Off to the right lay the rugged foothills and dim, brown mountains of St. Kitts. Appropriately enough, this boy destined to be America's foremost Anglophile entered the world as a British subject, born on a British isle in the reign of George II. He was slight and thin-shouldered and distinctly Scottish in appearance, with a florid complexion, reddish-brown hair, and sparkling violet-blue eyes. One West Indian mentor who remembered Hamilton as bookish and rather delicate and frail marveled that he had mustered the later energy for his strenuous American exploits. Like everyone in the West Indies, Hamilton had extensive early exposure to blacks. In this highly stratified society, with its many gradations of caste and color, even poor whites owned slaves and hired them out for extra income. In 1756, 1 year after Hamilton was born, his grandmother, Mary Fawcett, now residing on the Dutch island of St. Eustatius, made out her final will and left my three dear slaves, Rebecca, Flora, and Esther, to her daughter Rachel. Hamilton probably did not have formal schooling on Nevis. His illegitimate birth may well have barred him from Anglican instruction, but he seems to have had individual tutoring. His son later related that rarely as he alluded to his personal history, he mentioned with a smile his having been taught to repeat the Decalogue in Hebrew at the school of a Jewess when so small that he was placed standing by her side upon a table. This charming vignette squares with two known facts. Elderly women in the Caribbean commonly tutored children, and Nevis had a thriving population of Sephardic Jews, many of whom had escaped persecution in Brazil and entered the local sugar trade. By the 1720s, they constituted one quarter of Charlestown's white population and created a synagogue, a school, and a well-kept cemetery that survives to this day. His French Huguenot mother may also have instructed Hamilton, for he was comfortably bilingual and later was more at ease in French than Franklin, Adams, Jefferson, and other American diplomats who had spent years struggling to master the tongue in Paris. Perhaps from this exposure at an impressionable age, Hamilton harbored a lifelong reverence for Jews. In later years, he privately jotted on a sheet of paper that the progress of the Jews, from their earliest history to the present time, has been and is entirely out of the ordinary course of human affairs. Is it not then a fair conclusion that the cause also is an extraordinary one? In other words, that it is the effect of some great providential plan? Later on, in the heat of a renowned legal case, Hamilton challenged the opposing counsel, "Why distrust the evidence of the Jews? Discredit them and you destroy the Christian religion. Were not the Jews witnesses of that pure and holy, happy and heaven-approved faith, converts to that faith?" For a boy with Hamilton's fertile imagination, Nevis's short history must have furnished a rich storehouse of material. He was well situated to witness the clash of European powers with incessant skirmishes among French, Spanish, and English ships and swarms of marauding pirates and privateers. The Admiralty Court sat in Nevis, which meant that swaggering buccaneers in manacles were dragged into the local courthouse before proper hangings in Gallows Bay. While some pirates were just plain freebooters, many were discreetly backed by warring European nations, perhaps instructing Hamilton in the way that foreign powers can tamper with national sovereignty. Periodically, cutthroats came ashore for duels, resorting to conventional pistols or slashing one another with heavy cutlasses. Thrilling fare for any boy. Blood feuds were routine affairs in the West Indies. Plantation society was a feudal order, predicated on personal honor and dignity, making duels popular among whites who fancied themselves noblemen. As in the American South, an exaggerated sense of romantic honor may have been an unconscious way for slaveholders to flaunt their moral superiority, purge pent-up guilt, and cloak the brutish nature of their trade. To the extent that dueling later entranced Hamilton to an unhealthy degree, this fascination may have originated in the most fabled event in Nevis in the 1750s. In 1752, John Barbeau, a young Nevis lawyer, and Matthew Mills, a wealthy planter from St. Kitts, were bickering over a land deal when Mills lashed out at Barbeau as an impertinent puppy, the sort of fighting words that prompted duels. One day at dawn, elegantly clad in a silver-laced hat and white coat, Barbeau was rowed over to St. Kitts by a slave boy. At a dueling ground at Frigate Bay, he encountered Mills, lifted his silver-mounted pistol, and slaughtered him at close range. At the sensational murder trial, it was alleged that Barbeau had gunned down Mills before the latter even had a chance to grab his pistol from his holster. A star witness was Dr. William Hamilton, a possible relation of James Hamilton, who testified that Mills had been shot in the side and therefore must have been ambushed. Certain elements of this trial almost creepily foreshadow the fatal clash between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. Barbeau, well-bred yet debt-ridden, sneered at the soft-hearted notion that he had murdered the popular Mills, claiming that he had killed him fairly according to the notions of honor prevailing among men. Barbeau insisted that Mills had aimed his pistol at him even as he absorbed the fatal bullet. As was to happen with Aaron Burr, locals testified that Barbeau, in ungentlemanly fashion, had taken target practice in the preceding weeks. Barbeau was eventually convicted and packed off to the gallows. Nevis children such as Hamilton, who was born 3 years later, would have savored every gory detail of this history. Violence was commonplace in Nevis, as in all the slave-ridden Sugar Islands. The 8,000 captive blacks easily dwarfed in number the 1,000 whites, a disproportion, remarked one visitor, which necessarily converts all such white men as are not exempted by age and decrepitude into a well-regulated militia. Charlestown was a compact town of narrow, crooked lanes and wooden buildings, and Hamilton would regularly have passed the slave auction blocks at Market Shop and Crosses Alley and beheld barbarous whippings in the public square. The Caribbean sugar economy was a system of inimitable savagery, making the tobacco and cotton plantations of the American South seem almost genteel by comparison. The mortality rate of slaves hacking away at sugarcane under a pitiless tropical sun was simply staggering. 3 out of 5 died within 5 years of arrival, and slave owners needed to replenish their fields constantly with fresh victims. One Nevis planter, Edward Huggins, set a sinister record when he administered 365 lashes to a male slave and 292 to a female. Evidently unfazed by this sadism, a local jury acquitted him of all wrongdoing. A decorous British lady who visited St. Kitts stared aghast at naked male and female slaves being driven along dusty roads by overseers who flogged them at regular intervals, as if they needed steady reminders of their servitude. Every 10 Negroes have a driver who walks behind them, holding in his hand a short whip and a long one, and you constantly observe where the application has been made. Another British visitor said that if a white man kills a black, he cannot be tried for his life for the murder. If a Negro strikes a white man, he is punished with the loss of his hand, and if he should draw blood, with death. Island life contained enough blood-curdling scenes to darken Hamilton's vision for life, instilling an ineradicable pessimism about human nature that infused all his writing. All of the horror was mingled incongruously with the natural beauty of turquoise waters, flaming sunsets, and languid palm fronds. In this geologically active zone, the hills bubbled with high sulfur hot springs that later became tourist meccas. The sea teemed with lobster, snapper, grouper, and conch, while the jungles were alive with parrots and mongooses. There were also monkeys galore, green vervets shipped from Africa earlier in the century. Many travelers prized the island as a secluded refuge, one finding it so captivating that he contended that if a man came there with his wife, he might linger forever in the sweet recess of Nevis. It was all very pleasant and balmy, supremely beautiful and languid, if you were white, were rich, and turned a blind eye to the black population expiring in the canebrakes. If Rachel thought that Johann Michael Levian's appetite for revenge had been sated in Christian stead, she was sadly disabused of this notion in 1759. 9 years after Rachel had fled St. Croix, Levian surfaced for one final lesson in retribution. Oppressed by debt, he had been forced to cede his most recent plantation to two Jewish moneylenders and support himself as a plantation overseer while renting out his